What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
Well, it's been a while since I played that intro. Mark Latham joins us this afternoon, the leader of One Nation in New South Wales. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Well, thanks, Brent. It's always good to talk to you. So, yeah, after a bit of a break, it's good to be having a chat.
Anthony Albanese has brushed off concerns about support for the Voice to Parliament dropping, saying the public is focused on other issues right now, such as cost of living. It seems as though the public may be focused on cost of living, but the Prime Minister isn't. I mean, the Prime Minister seems to be just focused on the Voice, although every time that accusation is made, he tells you, no. He only ever talks about the Voice when he's asked about the Voice.
Well, it's been his flagship endeavour, hasn't it? It's been the number one thing he's pushed as Prime Minister, so I think that's part of the problem, isn't it? People have got higher priorities, and he's left the whole Voice proposition as very vague. Australians aren't silly. Australians aren't going to vote for a blank cheque. They want more detail and a justification for changing the constitution. I saw some figures the other day where something like Labor governments put forward 26 referenda propositions in Australia and only been successful once. So Labor hasn't got a strong record in this area, and the trend, of course, is as you get closer to the vote, the no vote tends to go up, people get more sceptical. So at this stage, you'd say the Voice being carried is long odds. It looks like it's bound to go down in Queensland, WA, South Australia and Tasmania. It seems to only have majority support in New South Wales and Victoria. But that's not enough. You need a majority of votes in the Commonwealth and a majority of states. So, yeah, I think Albanese's flagship is gradually sinking.
Why do you think, if that be the case, I mean, why do you think that he just doesn't instruct his ministers, the people that are involved in this, the people that are talking to the journalists? Why doesn't he instruct them, Mark, to start answering questions rather than avoiding answers?
Well, it's a mystery. You know, in politics, you've got to give people detail. And if you want to change the Australian Constitution, something historically that's very hard to do, you've got to give people valid reasons. And I think if you ask the average person in the street, what do you think of the Voice? They'd say, well, it's something I've heard of, but it's so vague, how can I vote for it unless I know what it really involves? And what will it do in practice? We haven't had a single example of what this new organisation will do to make the life of Indigenous Australians better. And it's not as if we don't spend enough money on Indigenous welfare, Indigenous affairs. There's something like 85 government-funded Indigenous advisory bodies around Australia, federal, state. Why do we need an 86th? These are the questions people are asking quite properly, but they're not getting answers from ministers, and you just have to say it's a complete political misjudgment at this stage.
The Indigenous Australians Minister, Linda Burney, she's going around and she'll speak to anyone that will talk to her about it, and she's saying, as she did a couple of weeks ago, I think you're overseas at the time, she did a presser at the National Press Gallery, and she was highlighting that we're going to focus on health, education, all these sort of things. I mean, health, education, homelessness, that's all been focused on for years and years and years. And Linda Burney has been part of this discussion about all of these things that she raised for many years because she's been in and around Parliament in an Indigenous role for almost 40 years, Mark. I just want to know what is going to be done differently that will get a better result for Indigenous Australians.
Well, exactly, and Linda Burney herself is a classic example of someone who's had 40 years in public life. She was once involved with various land councils and advisory groups in New South Wales, became a New South Wales Member of Parliament, became a New South Wales Minister, went into the Federal Parliament, became a Federal Minister, all the time focusing on Indigenous affairs. I mean, after 40 years, if Linda Burney herself hasn't worked out the answers, why is a new committee going to do any better? And I think this is the sort of thing that the voters look at and say, well, the new committee is either one of two things. It's not worth doing because it hasn't got a specific mandate and answers, or secondly, it's an act of deception. It's going to be something different to what they're telling me. You know, there's something going on behind the scenes here. They want to get this thing through, and then it ends up as reparations or land rights claims or things that we weren't really told about in the first instance. So when you've got all that doubt and suspicion hanging around The Voice and someone like Linda Burney, who after 40 years can't provide the answers herself for Aboriginal people, well, why would anyone vote for The Voice?
Anthony Albanese was on this network, I think, on the breakfast show on Monday or Tuesday of this week. He's been on other radio programs this week and basically saying, as I said to you at the start of our chat here, that the public is focused on other issues at the moment, cost of living. But he goes on and says, as it gets closer to the date, people will change their focus and they will start to think about The Voice and you will see the yes vote increase. Now, that's what he's saying. Do you think he really believes that?
No, that's never happened before in the history of referenda debates and issues in Australia. Normally the trend is that the no vote rises gradually as you get closer, and there's no historical precedent for the yes vote dipping and then rising again in the weeks running up to the date. We haven't even got the date at this stage. And the other thing that's unusual about The Voice is that no government has ever been elected and had its number one priority as a constitutional change. Normally governments have got bigger things to do for all Australians. You know, Whitlam had Medibank, what we now call Medicare. Hawke and Keating had the major economic reform, so did Howard and Costello. So no government's ever come in and said, look, the number one thing that we want to do in Australia is change the constitution. And Albanese can't possibly think that he's on a winner here. He's watching it slide away and he's looking for excuses, really. I think that's what the interview was about. A whole set of new excuses to make it look a bit better for himself.
Do you think if the no vote wins, it will have any effect, adverse effect, on Anthony Albanese's leadership?
You wouldn't say so at this stage, because he's still doing okay in the polls. They won a by-election in Victoria, which is very unusual, unprecedented in government since World War I. So you'd have to say that the Labor Party would have a fair bit of confidence in him, and they've all been in on it, haven't they? There's been no Labor Party dissent to say, look, The Voice really shouldn't be our top priority as a government. We should fix the cost of living issues, as we promised in the election campaign. There's no Labor Party members out there who've been sceptical about The Voice themselves. So they've supported Albanese down the line. I don't think it'll have leadership ramifications, other than it will be a major hole in his credibility with the public, that if you can't get your number one policy through, well, what good are you as Prime Minister? So, you know, I don't think it's a problem inside the Labor Party, but certainly beneficial for Peter Dutton as he tries to get rid of the Albanese government.
Mark, if the no vote wins, what other avenues are there for the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, to get it over the line in some other form?
Yeah, good point. I think it's the case that South Australia's already legislated a voice for their state. Victoria's on the pathway to doing that. I won't be surprised if New South Wales tries to do it. So the states, in their own capacity, could set up these various committees in various iterations, and Albanese could legislate it through the federal parliament. They might fall back and say, well, we'll just pass an act of parliament that sets up an equivalent body. But that in itself, I think, is political dynamite, because do you really go out there against the will of the people?
Yes.
When you've invested so much in saying you can vote for this and make it happen and make it a permanent feature of our constitution, if the people reject it, do you then turn around and say, well, no, we'll just do it anyway? What was the point in having the referendum if they were going to do it anyway? And the slap in the face for the states that vote against it, like Queensland and Western Australia, would be enormous, because obviously Dutton and others would be saying in those states, well, you've been railroaded here by the support that it had in New South Wales and Victoria. So for the smaller states, politically, it would be a catastrophe to go down that path.
And as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong here, Mark, but if he was to go about it that way, it doesn't form part of the Constitution, does it?
No, you can only change the Constitution by referenda, and that is needing a majority of votes in a majority of states. So there's no way of, you know, making some sneaky change to the Constitution. It's got to be a public vote. But you can legislate it. They've probably got the numbers to legislate it, looking at the Senate. But, politically, it would be a very, very courageous move to go down that path, a slap in the face for anyone who voted no.
All right, let's talk about the Victorian Commonwealth Games. I'm sorry I'm laughing, but it's been just such a total embarrassment, not only for Dan Andrews, not only for Victoria, but also on a world stage for Australia. I mean, Dan Andrews came out a couple of days ago and said, well, I'm sorry, we've done the books and we can't afford to host the Commonwealth Games in 2026, so we're going to cancel it. I'm just so surprised about the fact that I don't know, Mark. What I'm shocked about is that it took so long for the politicians to wake up and realise it was going to cost a whole lot more in reference to money than they initially thought.
Well, yeah, it's stunningly embarrassing for Australia, known as a great sporting nation, a nation that successfully hosted Olympic Games in the past, a nation that really is one of the leaders of the Commonwealth Games in terms of performance and enthusiasm. It's hugely humiliating on the world stage that Victoria's backed out, 3 years from the event, and there's now the question, can the Commonwealth Games themselves survive into the future? Did Victoria in the end kill the Commonwealth Games? And why did it take so long to work this out? But I've got to say, Brent, I thought from the beginning it was a weird, weird proposition that the Commonwealth Games were going to be hosted in regional Victoria,
yeah.
That places like Bendigo and Ballarat would have an opening ceremony, that somehow they thought they'd get the critical crowd mass to make the events financially viable, when Melbourne itself is such a great sporting nation, it's got all those facilities there. It must have been a political pitch to even say that regional Victoria could do this. It was never financially viable. Various experts told them that, apparently. They tried to hang on and in the end ended up with a huge egg on their face. So you can only hope the Commonwealth Games go on. I think most people have enjoyed them. They enjoy Australia's success in them. They've got a great history. The Commonwealth itself is fairly important. It's as humiliating a back down for a state government as you'll ever see, particularly when a state government gets on the international stage this way.
And Victorian taxpayers still have to pay a multi-billion-dollar Commonwealth Games bill to cover continued project work and the compensation they'll have to pay out as well. So Victorian taxpayers wouldn't be happy about this.
No, they keep voting him in, though, down there. There's a whole bunch of things. Victoria was the most locked-down part of the world during COVID. Andrews has got plenty of controversy about him all the time, but seems to get re-elected with big margins because of the weakness of the Liberal Party opposition there. Yeah, but for the taxpayer, they're throwing money down the drain, aren't they? They've got to pay compensation for something that was never viable in the first place. They've now reassessed the sums, looked at the $6-7 billion bill and backed out. So it's a loss of reputation, a loss of money, and you'd have to say a loss of this basic competence of the Andrews government. They just look like a pack of fools, don't they?
The Matildas will take to the field at 8 o'clock tonight against Ireland at Stadium Australia in Sydney. I see some statistics here, Mark. A win probability, they're putting it at 74% to the Matildas, 9% to Ireland, and a 17% probability of a draw. There are record crowds. Tickets for the game at the stadium are officially sold out with a bumper crowd forecast. What are they saying? More than 80,000 people are going to attend this match.
Yeah, it's a great boost for women's soccer in Australia, isn't it? I mean, it's the world game. It's so popular overseas. It's had its struggles, what internationally they call football, here in Australia. The A-League now goes pretty well, and our men's team plays quite successfully at the World Cup, you'd say, so it's a chance for the women to step forward. Yeah, it's a great sporting event, and unlike the Commonwealth Games in Victoria, it's going ahead, which is good news. And the eyes of the world will be very much on Australia out of this. I've recently been in London, where there was so much publicity about their team competing here, so much interest. So you can only hope the Australian girls go well, that they play up to expectations, that they're successful tonight, and the event is a great success for Australia and New Zealand, the host nation. So, yeah, it's pretty exciting, actually.
Sam Kerr will take to the stage, I suppose you could say, in many ways. Boy, oh boy, hasn't she done well? I was reading some figures last night. Last year she earned $3.3 million, and they say that a pay packet estimated to be more than 10 times that if they take out the cup, if they were to be lucky enough to take out the cup. And at the moment, in reference to sale of jerseys, Nike report that they are, the women's team are outselling the men's team in reference to popularity of jerseys.
Yeah, well, Sam Kerr is one of those sports people that's a much bigger name internationally than she is in Australia. She's very popular here and very successful, obviously, as our best player. But if you visit Stamford Bridge there in London, the great Chelsea team, she's on the wall, the Wall of Honour for their great players. So, yeah, she's been very successful. We've got our sports here that we love, cricket, rugby league, AFL, of course. But you go to some of those European nations, Brent, and it's a religion. You know, football there, what we call soccer, is a complete religion. And people invest so much in it, even in their off-season. The publicity in London for the men and women's game is just non-stop. So, yeah, Sam Kerr has a real chance here to do something special, to be recognised as the best player in the world. And for Australia, again, that's a tremendous thing.
Just quickly, the New South Wales government has been accused of bowing to pressure from gambling lobbyists after confirming its promised expanded cashless gaming trial was delayed.
Well, I don't know why people are so sceptical about a trial. You know, I've been around politics a while and seen policies that are successful, policies that are unsuccessful, and you normally find that a trial, having a smaller scale look at something you've never tried before, is a wise way to go, and you can scale up if the trial is successful. So the cashless gaming card has potential. Problem gambling is an issue in society that needs to be addressed. But you don't have to do everything with a big bang change. You know, there's a lot of zealots out there in this gaming debate who don't like licensed clubs, don't like the people who go to the clubs and put a few dollars through the pokies. They don't like the idea of gambling at all. You know, there's some people who'll stand up and they're so authoritarian in their attitudes, they basically say, well, I don't like gambling, no one should be able to do it. Well, you can't have that in a free society. So all that zealotry, I think, is just over the top. It is wise in an area like this to run a trial, see if it's successful, and if it is, scale it up. If it's not successful, we'll go back to the drawing board. So I'm very supportive of the trial. I think it does have legitimate support in the clubs movement, the clubs that are participating, and hopefully it does a lot of good. Hopefully it's a tangible way of addressing problem gambling. We learn a lot from the trial, and it can be rolled out then on a much larger scale.
Well said, well said. Gee, it's good to have you back. Nice to talk to you. Thanks for joining us. It goes so quick. We will look forward to talking to you next Thursday, same time, all right?
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks, Brent. All the best.